Ninth session of Line of Fire, Retrospect and Remembrance. Henry Wiledo, National Commander of the American Defenders of Bataan and Corregidor, describes his experience following the Japanese invasion of the Philippines and the forced American withdrawal into the Bataan Peninsula. Amid starvation and disease, he survived the Bataan Death March and 42 months as a prisoner of war. Half a century later, he bids the generations that follow not to forget this time in history.
I had lunch today with two of my Bataan buddies and their wives, who made up another famous historical war place, Wayside Inn. As we had lunch there one day, or rather we had dinner one day, and in came the Fife and Drum Corps playing and marching through the place. What a surprise and what a nice thing it was to see them. So while we were there, one of the women said a lady outside looked at her number plate on her car and it said EX POW 392 or whatever the number was on the plate. And the lady asked, what's POW mean? She said, well, that's a prisoner of war. You know, people who were in the Philippines and were on Bataan and they made the death march. What's a death march? So I think that the schools are lacking in teaching all the things that are important in history. One school doesn't that I know of, and that's the Bedford High School. I spoke there one year, and the history teacher who ran the opportunity for us to speak said that he taught about World War II and the Pacific end of it in two semesters in his high school. So they were the students were very knowledgeable, and had some very tough questions too. Well, as you announced, I did enlist in December of 1940 and got to the Philippines. A few funny things happened along the way. They made me a sergeant before I became a private. They made me a temporary sergeant. No uniform, no stripes. But I was put in charge of 17 youngsters like myself to take them from Denver, Colorado to San Francisco by train. One of them got sick on the way, so when we got to, I think it was Reno, and the fellows wanted to know if they could get off the ship and go get a drink, and I said, sure, I'll stay here and watch this guy who's in charge. I had to take care of him. Well, they came back and nobody had a drink in their hip pocket for me. I was upset. I wasn't really a very good administrator. But we had 8 months of, I had 8 months of a wonderful existence at Camp John Hay up in Baguio in the Philippines. We didn't have what you would call regular duty. Our commander said to us, our colonel, I don't want to be saluting you guys all day, so just salute me once in the morning and that's it. We were through at 12 o'clock, we didn't have to salute them anymore anyway after that. And I worked in a commissary as an auditor and saw all the famous people come up to Camp John Hay, which was an R&R camp, recreation and rest camp. And that was the summer capital of the Philippines. Quezon, President Quezon of the Philippines had come there, General MacArthur, General Wainwright. So you saw all the biggies, and after a while, you know, they were just another person. Well, at the end of the 8 months, we heard some airplanes flying overhead, and we came out of the commissary to look. And I'm standing beside a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and he says, look at those beautiful B-17s. And they opened their bomb bay doors and they hit us. It was a Japanese plane. So that's the only time they really did any damage. They killed one American who had just got there the night before to work up at Camp John Hay in the officers club, and about 7 or 8 Filipinos. We were so green. We had no recruit training, no close-order drill, no red face, white face. that they wouldn't allow us to have any guns when the war broke out. They said we hurt ourselves, which was true. We had a fellow who was in the Army for a long time, had come from Hawaii to do his tour of duty in the Philippines, and he was in the Queen Anne's Rifles or something. They could take a rifle and do that with it on their finger. But he's sitting, we broke into a magazine and broke into the box's rifle cartons there, and we took out Lee Enfields from World War I and got the Cosmoline off, and so we had rifles. Well, he's playing with his and it goes off. He shot the darn thing and almost got his nose and hit a branch and fell down, hit him in the head. And I said, you were in the Army for 5 years? What are you going to show us? Well, we were running around with machetes. So we were protecting the camp. And we were there from up until about the 23rd, I think, of December, when all of a sudden word came that the Japanese were coming up the zigzag trail. It's about a 150-mile road. And during the rainy season, it gets washed out about 50 times a year on the average. And nothing can go up that road. And it's a true zigzag trail, so that if we put 130 caliber machine gun at any one of those points, we could have held anybody off, because one side would be a straight cliff going up, and down was a drop of about 300 or 400 feet. So nobody elected to fight. They said that you got to leave camp. You can't go back to the barracks and take anything that you want that's yours. Just get out here and get ready to march. So there's about 30 of us. They marched us out. There was a colonel and two captains, I think, and a lieutenant. And we got out into the jungle, and they called us together and said, here's 20 pesos apiece, you're on your own. How kind of an army is this? I said, but what do we know about the jungle? And this one didn't. They gave us any food, no medicine, no guns, no ammunition. We did have, I guess we had a 30 caliber machine gun that the Filipino scouts, who were the best dug-on soldiers I ever saw anywhere, I guess. And they had one, and but the rest of us, we didn't have any weapons. In fact, I don't think I even carried my machete with me that day. But when we stopped outside of the commissary storehouse, the doors were wide open, and I said, we got no food, you know. Can we go in there and get something? He said, what do you want, raw meat? Ain't gonna do you any good. I said, well, let's go in and look anyway. So I saw some salami hanging. There were about 50 of them. Nobody wanted any. They were not salami eaters. And so I grabbed one and stuck it in my zip bag. And so when people started to lack of water, they were very thirsty and they couldn't march. They were falling down and didn't want to go any further. Slice off a couple of hunks of salami and gave it to them, and they'd be on their feet and we'd get some water. Well, those are the fun things. We got about 80 miles through the jungle. All the officers, well, we called them together and we said, look, you're in charge of us, you're responsible. We are not going off on our own. We don't know where to go. We don't know this area. Then you should have some understanding because you've been doing duty here for some time. So they said, okay, and we got together and marched 80 miles through the jungle up down mountains. And got out to the main highway, number 5, in a town called Arataw. There were thousands of cases of type C rations lined up all up and down the road, and the American troops were gone south. We found a bus, we all climbed in, put the 30 caliber on top of the bus, and off we went down Highway 5, just singing songs and driving along and talking about home and whatnot, right through the middle of all the Japanese on both sides of us that we didn't know were there. And there were 500 of them on bicycles that were following us, but we didn't see them. At the end of the trip, we come to the Cabanatuan River, which was in front of the town of Cabanatuan. It's a pretty large city in the Pampanga province. And the bridge was down, so we get out of the bus and we started to crawl on the broken parts of the bridge until we get on the other side. And as we get on the other side, the colonel came up and said, you know, I almost killed you guys. I was lucky that a Filipino said, those are white faces in the bus, sir. Don't shoot them. He had 3-inch guns on that side of the river. And as we got across and left to get into wherever we were going to be, but the troops came out to that side of the river, the side that we had left, and they, unfortunately for the Japanese, they shot them all. They got them front and rear, and with their bicycles they couldn't move, so they wiped them out. And we didn't know anything about it until about the 7 o'clock news that night. I'm taking a shower, and I heard about all these troops who were chasing the bus down the highway. Well, that was the kind of thing that went on. Things were kind of haphazard. I was assigned to a motor pool to see that nobody took vehicles without proper documents. They used to come up to the Filipinos who were in charge and say, here's a pass, this is my requisition, I need this kind of a car or that kind of a car. And they give it to them, they didn't know any better. So we had to put a stop to that according to management. So two enlisted men, privates, were put in charge. Neither one of us had any right. We had a great time. We're eating salmon and rice out of the old boiler wash kettles, the oval shape that your mother's probably used and put on the stove and boil the clothes in it. That's where they cooked our food. And you said to yourself, well, there's a war on, but when are we going to see some enemy? We never saw any enemy. We saw airplanes, and we ducked every time they came by. We got on Bataan, and I was in General King's headquarters, attached, and we were the quartermaster corps out of Camp John Hay, attached to the general staff. Unfortunately for our colonel, that meant that he was a stepchild and not a true member of the family. So we got all the dirty jobs. We ducked the foxholes. We did anything that anybody else didn't want to do, like put 50 rounds of ammunition in the back of your sedan and drive it up to the front line, 3-inch shells. Want anything, right? Hit you, I'd be fool heaven. So they called me in one day and said, you've been doing a pretty good job. How'd you like to be second lieutenant? I'm looking at them, I don't know what to say. I said, what am I going to have to do as a second lieutenant? They said, where did you have your training? I said, what training? 18 weeks indoctrination, boot camp. I said, I never had any. I said, how'd you get me on? I said, I signed up. They put me on a ship, sent me over here, and that people up in Camp John, they didn't do anything like that. So he said, you kill more of the Filipinos than you would the Japanese. You don't know what to do, so you're not going to be a second lieutenant. A few weeks later, General Homer decided that he wanted to keep his rank and not get cashiered and sent home in disgrace. Brought in 250,000 troops from Singapore and from China, and he overran us in about 5 days. We had 5,000 Americans on the front line with 30 caliber machine guns. We didn't have anything bigger than that. The 105 cannons that we had, we've lost them, and they didn't even throw the breech loaders out of them, and so that the Japanese couldn't use them, and they were firing them back at us. And we had about 18,000-20,000 Filipinos who were just trained maybe 5 weeks before the war broke out, so they weren't trained. And every time one of them felt like he wanted to go home, they'd just say, I'm tired, my feet hurt, I miss my buddy, and off they'd walk, and all of a sudden there'd be a hole in the line, and the Japanese had come pouring through, so they were not very reliable. They were good fighters, and they did what they were told, but when anything came up that they felt that wasn't to their best interest, off they'd go. So the war ended on April 9th. We were blowing up all the ammunition dumps. I was assigned as what the English used to call a bat boy. I was an orderly to my colonel, and we put his trunks and luggage and everything in a truck, and they were in the sedan riding, and another fellow, myself, around the truck, and every time the Japanese came by, because the troops were leaving the area and going in the opposite direction, and we were going down to a collection point called Maravillas, which is at the tip of the Bataan Peninsula facing Corregidor. Manila is over here, we got Manila Bay here, and the Bataan Peninsula is here. And so Maravillas is at the foot of the peninsula, and Corregidor is over here. So Corregidor had guns that couldn't reach the airplanes as yours couldn't. And so they just dumped everything from 25,000 feet on Corregidor. Corregidor was shooting at batteries across the bay onto, as you're leaving Marvelous and start going north, the Japanese marched us in front of the line of fire so that the Americans wouldn't shoot, but they didn't know we were marching. There were about 5,000 at a time in lines of march, four abreast, and some of us got hurt, some of us got killed. We marched, and I had no food for 6 days, very little water. You didn't dare drink water in an ordinary stream because there would be dead animals maybe 500 yards up the road. If you did drink, you'd find something that you shouldn't be doing that. And about the 6 days, somebody gave me some iodine and said, look, when we stop near water, dig a hole a foot away, let it fill in, and fill the canteen cup, canteen up, and put some iodine in it. Stir it, let it sit for a while and drink it, and you know, there won't be any bacteria. So I got a little to drink that way. Finally, I passed out. I'm in the field. They always marched you early in the morning, sat you down about 11 o'clock, and you'd stay in the field until 4 in the afternoon in all the hot sun, 110, 115 degrees, while the guards were in the shade. It's one thing I got to say that everybody says what a terrible thing the death march is. I'm wondering how Americans would have handled it if they had 15 or 20 guards with 5,000 prisoners marching in the road, that you could be out of sight of a guard for maybe 2 minutes at a time. And so anytime anybody fell and nobody picked them up to help carry them, the Japanese shot them because they had no way of taking care of anybody that fell by the road. So they killed by bayoneting and shooting about 650 Americans, and I don't know how many Filipinos. It must have been in the neighborhood of 2,000 or 3,000 at least. Because whenever they went out of line and ran off in the field, say there was sugar cane growing, they wanted to get something to eat, they just step up to the edge of the road and just do whatever they were doing. We made the march anywhere from 6 to 16 days. When I realized that I was getting, you know, when I fell and almost passed out, a buddy of mine grabbed me and pulled me in the shade. The Japanese let us go in the river that afternoon. Why, I don't know. And so we all stripped and went in the water, and, you know, the moisture going through the pores helped a lot and recovered a lot. And we were finally, we were so happy, we were jumping up and down and laughing and everything. And suddenly everybody started hollering, hey, hey, there's people looking. We turned around and there must have been 300 or 400 Filipino families lined up under the branches where they were, at the trees in the shade, where they were marching trying to get back because a lot of them had gotten out of the fighting area and they wanted to go back to their homes. So I got a little to eat. They brought me up to the house at the end of this field where we were all resting to start marching again, and they fed me a little bit of fish and rice soup. And I got back my strength a little, and they put me on a truck and drove about 3 or 4 miles to the next collecting or stopping point for the night. I realized then, hey, if I stay here and not go with my group, but stay behind when the next group comes up, I'll get an extra day's rest. So I did that, and my 6 days stretched to about 13. And then, one day there was a fellow, must have been, when you start twisting your arms and legs all over, epileptic. I knew he was going to die. He was an epileptic, and he was very, very bad. Nobody could control him or hold him. So a guard came up and to another fellow, myself, and said, with motions, you know, take him, move him, carry him, something, whatever. So I saw an Artesian well by the side of the road, and I said to the guy, let's bring him over there and push his face into that, because that's coming out very strong. Maybe the cold water will shock him. And I didn't know what to do. I had no medical training at all. So we tried that, and that didn't happen. That didn't do any good. So we laid him down on the ground, and I got up to the guard and I said, boy, I got to do it this time. So I talked him into getting us a truck, like motions, truckle, you know, I don't know what they understood in English. And we got a truck. And there was a two-story building on the side of the road. were Japanese officers in it, and they were up in the second story, and they saw us helping this guy onto the truck, and a Carabao cop came up. Carabao's like a water officer in the Philippines, and he had about a dozen other men that had fallen by the road, and the Japanese allowed them to be picked up and moved by this vehicle. So they put those people on the truck. And the Japanese officers sent down a wastebasket filled with white bread that they had hollowed out, pulled out the soft part to eat, and were throwing the rest away, the crust, the bread, you know. And I said, we get something to eat. But they sent the bread down before the cart came up. So as I cut a slice off to give to the fellow that was epileptic, to my buddy, up comes the cart. Well, I had to cut slices for them. Pretty soon I'm looking at it and say, save a little piece for myself. That's the time I recognized and realized that if you help somebody else, somehow God will help you. And that's what I did from then on. Wherever I could, I helped somebody. And in turn, I survived. So you have to have faith. We got into the end of the march was at San Fernando La Union. After a couple of days of a horrible, horrible place, pieces all over the area, and you had to sleep in it, but they wouldn't allow you outside this corralled area. So they put us on cargo trains, cars that probably are like the 40 and 8 that they had in the First World War in France, 40 men and 8 horses. Well, this had 100 Americans, and you could only stand belly to belly. And if you were standing up against the wall, 115 degree heat, guys get burned with their skin blistered from, and you couldn't move out of the way. Men died standing up. If you had to urinate or defecate, you did it standing up. They wouldn't allow you to go off the train. And we're on that train from about 8 in the morning, 8 in the morning until, I guess about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We got out then and had a march 12 miles, those of us who were left, and to get to Camp John Hay. When we arrived the next day, the commander stood up on a box, the Japanese commander, and said, you are not prisoners of war, you are captives, you surrendered, you did not fight. If you break our rules, we will kill you, or we will do something worse. And they did something worse. We lost 23 men every 24 hours. The non-coms didn't have to work in work details in that prison camp. Why, I don't know. I never found out why. But I got feeling a little apprehensive that they would put you on a detail you wouldn't want to be on. So I went up to the captain in charge of our area and said, I'd like to volunteer to work. What do you need? And he said, oh, good. We need a guy to be in charge of the cemetery. You're in charge of graves registration. And I met the captain who was really, truly in charge. He was the graves registration officer, and he told me what to do. Gave me 30 men, and we went out to dig graves. Well, when you dug with your shovel, you didn't get up a shovel of dirt. You come up with a slab of clay about the size of this top here. So you couldn't dig a grave 3x6. Charlie, right? So I measured out 10 graves, what would be 3 foot wide. So it was 30 feet long, 6 feet deep, and 6 feet wide. And we laid them down in the bottom of the graves, across their arms, and sent word out to get a chaplain to come out and say the prayers. The chaplains came out maybe once a week. And I said, I don't care whether he's a Catholic, or whether he's a rabbi, or whether he's a Protestant. We didn't have any other denomination. So I said, send me somebody so that we can have a service for the men. And when they didn't come, we would do the service ourselves. And we got back into camp to eat supper, and there wouldn't be any. There might be one-fourth of what the other people had to eat. Because when you're not there, and there's a little left, people eat a little bit more because they're hungry. We were all hungry. We all lost around 50 pounds. The normal loss of weight was about 50 pounds for a normal soldier. And some men were heavier and they lost more. So one day I had a man in there, and he wasn't digging. Oh, by the way, I'm sorry, I should be watching my cards, but I'm going to be talking too long if I go through all of them. When we found out we weren't getting anything to eat, 100 of us just automatically came together, and we started to march down to the captain's quarters, who was in charge of our area, and they were all, you know, hollering and saying, we've got to get something to eat, how can we work, heavy pick and shovel when we can't get enough to eat. We walked past 10 barracks. I turned around to say something, and I had 7 guys in back of me, drifted off, because we were getting closer and closer to the Japanese headquarters as well as the American captain's quarters. So I looked at them and I said, fellas, I'm not patting myself on the back, but I was scared. I know how people get beaten up. So I said, there's no need of 7 or 8 of us getting beat up. Why don't you appoint me a committee of one, and you guys stay out of sight and sweat and see what happens. So I went to see the captain, told him that there's 100 men back there waiting to see what I'd get for an answer. We don't get enough to eat. We don't get the regular rations we get when we don't work. So we want some food, or we're going to have a problem on our hands. So he said, you can't lead a riot. You'll never get to be a sergeant, like the top sergeant sitting next to you over here. I said, well, that's an example. And he never did anything for us. When we asked for help, he just ignored us. That I wouldn't want to be in the Army if that's what it is to be a sergeant. So he said, I'll see what I can do for you, Sergeant. So we got a call, and I don't know, it was a dinner bell or whatever it is they use, and we had a fourth meal that day, pancakes made out of rice flour and syrup from cane sugar. So my crowd is saying, wow, we can do this tomorrow? So when they asked me how many men I needed, I said, I need 40 men. So and they said, how come? I said, well, it's getting tougher to dig the graves. I built it up to 90 men. When I took the job over, the guys were working 50 minutes in a hot sun and getting a 10-minute break. We had a timekeeper who held a watch, and when the time was up, then we'd swap. So I'm looking at a guard tower probably about 200 yards away from us, and the guard's up there looking at us all the time. So I figured out that if we kept busy, he wouldn't know what the heck we were doing. So I arranged it in time that they would work 10 minutes and then go and rest for 50 minutes. But because of the number of trenches we were digging, I was able to keep the men moving and everybody getting a break. This was great. And then we were going in, and when I said, give my report as to how much food I needed, I always added about 30 men to how many I had. So we finally got enough to eat. We didn't get fat on it, but at least we felt that we could do our job. So one day, there's a man standing in the hole digging, leaning on a shovel, and I said, listen, I fixed it so you guys only have to wait 10 minutes now. Quit dogging it. Let's go. He said, with two expletives. And I said, what's the matter? He said, what do you care? He says, you guys are all alike. I said, look, talk to me. What's the matter? He said, I can't shovel with my hand. Fingers missing. I can't hold a shovel. So why don't you say something? He said, what good does it do? Nobody ever listened to me in my other camp. So I said, out of the hole, I made him the timekeeper. Where he was at. Next morning was Saturday. 11:30 or so, we're getting ready to quit work, taking care of all the bodies, and in comes 4 guys carrying a stretcher with a guy that looked pretty healthy and a handkerchief on his face. I said, what is this? The guy's got a gag here or something? What are you doing? And they said, no, Sarge, that's our buddy, he's dead. Took the handkerchief off, he was dead. He had an attack of malaria about noontime, just before noontime, because this was about 11:30 to 12 o'clock when they brought him out. And the doctor was going to lunch, and the kid who was the foreman, who was not medically trained but took the job as foreman, said to the doctor, hey doc, this guy's got malaria. I don't have any quinine, just quinidine. How much do I give him? He says, "Give him whatever needs." So the kid, not knowing anything, gave him the amount of quinine that was needed. He killed him. The guy dropped dead from his heart basically because he'd given too much quinidine. So the men carried the guy out to the cemetery. And I thought it was so strange that he was being buried in the same spot that he was in the day before. So those are the incongruities of any kind of an existence, but there it was doubly so because of what we were facing all the time. In June, all those who could walk were allowed to get on trucks to go to Tobacco. He would fall in. We'd have to go dig them out and wash them off. We only could take a bath or a shower in a can if you could get some water. Maybe once every 2 weeks you might be able to take a bath and clean yourself off. Men were dying from malaria because there was no quinine. I brought in about 200 tablets of quinine and turned them over to the hospital. And a buddy of mine got sick a week later, and I went up to get some quinine for him because he said he wasn't getting any. He said, "We don't have any." I said, "I turned some in." He said, "I don't know what you're talking about." So he was a tough GI. He'd been in the Army for a number of years, and he's laying there saying, "The country don't care for us. We're going to die. Nobody's going to save us." I said, "Knock it off." We went up every day to give him water and help him out, but he wouldn't eat his food. He let his mess get covered with flies, and he died 3 days later. He just gave up the ghost. And there was a lot of young kids who had cars, who had spending money, who didn't work for their allowance, were like that, and because we had a bunch of young kids come in the last 6 months, 18, 19, 20-year-olds who were in the National Guard, and they were called in and had to go to the Philippines. It was when the ambulatory men left, we had about 180 sick persons who were left behind. Most of them had holes this big in their rear ends because there were no beds in the hospital, and they threw sand on the floor when they messed themselves. So that got gangrenous, and you know, they were in bad shape. A lot of guys, that's the reason why a lot of guys were being buried. So just at the time that the ambulatory men left, a hospital from Baguio in Bataan came up with 115 truckloads of equipment and food. The Colonel Duckworth, who was in charge of the hospital, had three or four Japanese soldiers, and one was a major. The major had lost his leg, he had amputated. And when the surrender came, the Japanese were coming up the road in a tank and troops behind them. Colonel Duckworth didn't want soldiers to come in and find the Japanese there because he felt that they would be killed. So he stepped out in the road and put his hand up in front of the tank. And up comes a general out of the tank with a pistol aimed at Colonel Duckworth, and he spoke English. The upshot was that the general came in because the colonel wanted to turn the Japanese soldiers over to him. And he's walking down the ward, he stops at a bed, and it's his brother. And his brother says, "I've been treated better than if I was in my own home." So he said, "These are good people. They take care of anybody, whether they're Japanese or American." So they let him keep all his equipment, never took anything away, put guards around, not to let any other Japanese to come into that area, and gave them a gun and some ammunition to go shoot any animals or carabao, whatever they could find in the woods. And so that's how they came in to Camp O'Donnell with all the trucks. They saved about 80 men out of the 180. And the truck drivers who were going out on details during all this time from May until October were going out and buying a shopping bag full of groceries for about $5 or $10 from the Filipinos and coming in and selling corned beef and pineapple for $50 a can to the Americans. They were profiteers. When the Colonel Duckworth and his hospital came in, he set up a first aid tent out on the edge of the town of Capiz because the Japanese were letting the Filipinos out of the prison camp. So when they come up at the 12-mile height, and, you know, very little food and all that, so they would take care of him medically, whatever they needed. And Colonel Duckworth said, you can buy food and bring it in, but can only charge 10% more than what you paid for it. The profiteers went out of business. They had to come in all of Chatelaine and eat the same food we were eating because they ran out of theirs. A little of attribution there. We closed the camp in October. I was sent to Villabed for medical or whatever to check up, and then they put me out to work in an airfield to rebuild Nielsen Field. I hurt my leg after I was there a while, and I started to ulcerate, and the American doctor one day, he got forceps and he grabbed the hold of what he thought was proud flesh and started to yank it. He was yanking on my muscle. Just then the Japanese doctor in charge of the area of all the camps came up and saw my leg, didn't know what the doctor did, but saw my leg and said, why isn't this man in a hospital? And I don't know what transpired, but that afternoon I was on a truck and into Billabid Hospital that had all the medical equipment that they needed to take care of anybody under normal conditions. They had sulfanilamide, poured it on my leg for about 3 months, and they saved it. So when I got better, I had to go back to work. A friend of mine from Lynn said, Hank, did you do any play acting or anything like that, you know, at home? And I said, well, I did a little bit for local community groups. And he said, well, if you can do something, it will keep you here. You won't have to go back to work. So I started to write one horse operas, like the poor girl, you know, who the hero was going to marry, but they didn't have any money and the mortgage was due. Instead of the guy being the hero and going out to work, the girl went out to work. But the girl was the guy, and the guy got pregnant. And so it was, you know, as much of a farce as you possibly could build into it. And the first play that we did, I got the first two acts done and the first line of the third act on each part, and I said, I haven't got enough time to do any more. Wing it. Well, that was the biggest show that they had in that place. And we always, whatever we did a blackout. You know, you did a punchline and then you hit the curtain and that was the end of the show. We did things, I won't go into a lot of stories about it, but the Japanese were in the front row and they were enjoying it just as much as the Americans. But the last show I did was Hamlet and Juliet. And I had 9 Hamlets. And she was, Juliet would have the scene with the Hamlet on the stage, and then he'd go off the war or something, then another Hamlet would come, and then he'd go off stage because somebody else was coming. So when the 8 guys were behind the curtain, the first one comes back in and he said, what's this I hear about you fooling around while I'm gone? And she said, oh, I'm not doing anything. He said, if I ever hear of you doing it, he said, I'll cut you in half and throw the best part of you to the dogs. Out come the other 8. Why not? The Navy captain comes up to me and said, Hank, I think you've had it. It's time for you to go back to work. Well, I made an extra 3 months out of it. But there was a lot of fun. We did, in every camp where we had any talent at all, we'd try and put on shows and then invite the Japanese to come and see them. And there were a lot of bad things, like you were in 10-man squads, and if one of you escaped, the other 9 would be killed. There was 2 or 3 of those that happened, and they got their heads chopped off. There were times when, for instance, we're working on a farm, when I went to Cabana Tuan, one of my tours of duty, the guys were in a field in the V shape, like the Canadian geese, and they're supposed to be in a straight line. So the guard came up and felt that the guy in front was doing something wrong, so he stood him up and took a bamboo slat and beat his face until he became a pumpkin. The guy was out of commission for about 3 or 4 months. I don't think it was because the Japanese were mean as we think people are mean when they do something. I think that it was 2 things. One, it was their feeling that they were doing whatever they were doing for the emperor. There were many cases in history where in Japan, where one party was against someone else, and they would go and kill the leader of another party who might be an admiral or high-ranking official in the government. And when the trial came up, they'd say, I was doing it for the emperor because I didn't think he was conducting the business the right way, and they would get off doing it for the emperor. So it was this attitude that was there. But there was a lot of, when there's unleashed brutality, there was a lot more that was going on than should have been. It should have been more controlled. Cabana Tawan on my birthday on January 4th, 1944, to go on a 27-man detail, and I asked all my friends to go with me, and they said, oh no, everybody comes out of here, goes to Nielsen Field, and you're dead in about 4 months, because they were doing this thing, maybe we kill you, maybe we do something worse, like tie you to a tree and beat you to death in 4 or 5 days. So, and those who did, and they never let them die at Nichols Field. They brought him back to die in the Billabed Hospital, so that the evidence was there. So I said, no, I don't think so, because they want 150 to replace those that are dead. So that's not going to be for Nichols Field. Turned out to be Port Area. We were stevedores. I gained back my 50 pounds. I weighed about 185. I could pick up 100 kilos of rice and stack it up 10 stacks high, walking up each stack. We had a softball field. We had a boxing ring. We had taken the alleys out of a bowling alley and made dining room tables out of them. We had the privilege to use a barbecue fires. They allowed us to spend 3 to 20 pesos in their commissary. They wanted to know where we're getting all the money. And we said, we're rich Americans. They said, good, turn all your money in and we'll give you 20 pesos a month to spend. You can't spend any more than that. There isn't enough to buy. So the guys turned in some of their money, but they kept the most of it. And the reason why we were treated so well there, if we worked one day, we'd get the next day off. If we worked an hour, you get the second hour off. So you only work in a half a day. You could steal off the ships because they weren't military ships. They were cargo ships with goods coming down to the southern waters. They would bring in good cargo ships into Manila, unload them, and put them on rusty tubs and send them down south, because the American submarines were doing such a good job of knocking off the subs, the Japanese ships. So we had a good life there, but we were working all the time and trying to destroy whatever we could. I was involved in two things. One, we were loading rice on a ship that was going to go to China, and we kept calling for water, and we were ripping the bottom sacks and pouring water all over the rice so it would swell. When the ship got to Singapore, the rice was rotten, and the ship has 80,000 tons or something on it, and it was all spoiled. Another time we unloaded the alcohol drums, 55-gallon drums, and we unscrewed the caps and put them upside down so the fluid came out when it went out in the harbor. Cans banged, sparks, ship blew up. We'd see the wounded merchant marines coming in and getting their talk about doing it for the emperor. Then our two officers were two Navy men, and they were working with the Spanish underground. And between them, they were able to have somebody go and put dynamite or explosives, whatever, under the bow of the ship, and they blew it up. I saw the thing go up myself. It was probably saw a lot more than I did, but the ship went up like that, right up in the air. And we were on board a cargo vessel going to Japan in about 10 days. They didn't want us hanging around anymore. The reason why we were treated so well in that one camp and one camp only was because it was the camp that they brought the Swiss Red Cross, International Red Cross, to see how well they were treating Japanese. So we were a show camp. That's why we were being taken care of. I lost about 30 pounds in 18 days going to Japan, because when we were down in the hold, at least 600 in one hole and 900 in the one I was in. And you couldn't get up. I think they let us out twice and washed us down with hoses because we smelled so bad. But they would send the rice down the ladder and they'd send the feces buckets down the ladder. And the guys didn't care, our own guys. You'd be moving buckets and, oh, geez, well, I gotta move this one. So you pick it up off the floor and put it on top of another rice bucket, feces on the bottom. I didn't eat for 18 days. I just drank water and traded my rice for water so that I could get as much water as I could. I lost 18 pounds. We got into Moji, which was on the island of Honshu. Got on a train and ended up in a camp called Oyama, which was on the west side of the island of Honshu, opposite the city of Osaka. We were in the Osaka group. I worked in the nickel ore mine, and the nickel ore was for rifle batteries on the large guns. So we were helping the war effort of the Japanese, which was against all international regulations. And it was 13 months. I couldn't have lasted another one. My toes were weeping. They weren't bleeding or anything, but they were rotting away because we wore size 14 hip boots, rubber boots, and we were working in hot ore. And so there was no ventilation, and I guess your body just started to fall apart. I was down to 135 pounds. I was carrying men. We had to be weighed every month. I was carrying men to the scale who couldn't walk, and then we knew that they were in little 12-inch boxes because they had died and they were cremated. We had one Japanese civilian working with us, and he was in charge of us working inside the factory where we were shoveling, BBs, shoveling this nickel ore into containers or whatever they wanted. And when no other Japanese were around, he let us sit down, take a break, he'd give us a cigarette. And he got caught, and they put him back to work as a laborer. When the war ended, as we were marching out of our camp and went into town to get onto two trains that we commandeered to go to Yokohama and be with the Americans. Americans said, there's no reason to send troops out there and waste all that money. You guys can get a train and come in by yourselves. They had dumped so much food in 55-gallon drums from airplanes that we had plenty to eat. And in fact, human nature is what it is. You'd be in the latrine eating and eliminating at the same time, and then you'd go back and get some more to eat. And it was laughable now, but then you couldn't say to a guy, knock it off, well, you're going to get sick. But that's what you did. One guy got hit there was a case of peaches coming down the parachute, and it broke away and went through the roof. A friend of mine from Wisconsin, and it grazed his leg. If it moved, it would come down 6 inches more, would have killed him. So we got to Yokohama, and we saw white females. I hadn't seen one in 3.5 years. Beautifully coiffured, a great military dress, and the major, blonde, beautiful blonde major from Iowa, came towards us. And everybody said, oh, I wish I could talk to her. Comes over and stands in front of me and asks, is there anybody here from Iowa? And most of us were from New England, and that bench. And we said no, so she said she was sorry. She didn't greet us at the train. That was a job with her nurses, and they should have been there, but they were delayed somewhere else. And so she walked away. We were put on board a ship, and we were given nice, clean Navy bunks. I mean bunks, not canvas cots. And then the word comes over the PA system, there aren't enough beds for you non-coms. Down in the hold. Mine high, up against the side. Well, we slept on deck. We never slept downstairs. And so we got to Manila. It took us about a week, I guess, where it normally should have been maybe 18 hours, but the American submarines were out there. We didn't want to get hit.
So we got to Manila, and they sent us to a replacement depot about 35 miles south or west of Manila, and they couldn't find me. I was missing. It took 18 days to discover in Washington that I was a member of the United States Army. All the friends I had all went home, and I'm all by myself. So finally, I got on the ship and got into close to Pearl Harbor. We got into Honolulu, outside of the tower, the Aloha Tower, and they wouldn't let us off. It was quarantine. But they let a man come on with half pints of ice cream, cases of them. I ate 15 half pints of ice cream. I think I could do that now. I got more space, but I couldn't do that. That guy must have made a fortune. So we stayed there for a short time, and then the ship took off again. We got him in San Francisco, let him in General Hospital, probably about 2 weeks there. And they said, okay, you're well enough to be sent home. So they sent us as bed patients on a train, and got officers and nurses waiting on us hand and foot. They wouldn't allow enlisted men in to take care of us because we were prisoners of war from the Philippines and Japan. Well, I got home about the 4th, I think it was the 4th of November, and I was at, there's a place up here that's a military base. I know Hans can feel, but what's the settlement? Fort Devens. Oh, that's where we formed our national organization. On the 8th of November, I proposed to my wife, and she said yes. And she walked in the office with the ring, and they said, how long have you known the guy? He's only been home 4 days. We knew each other before I went away. But we started having meetings, and we decided to form a club where we could kick in 10 cents a month and have a beer bust at somebody's house. Well, it turned out to be a national organization, American Defenders of the Town in Corregidor. We got a charter in Massachusetts. We had our first convention in Boston on April 9th. We had 250,000 people watching this march. We had, I think, 43 states represented. It came all over from the United States to come to the first convention. Governor Tobin opened up our meeting. Now a governor won't go any near our organization because they don't know we're POWs. We're the American Defenders of Bataan and Corregidor. So I got married on June 17th, and I had three girls and two boys. Oh, Helen helped me. I knew she was in there somewhere. But we have 8 grandchildren. We're happy. But unfortunately, I think I'm back in Japanese prison camp. I'm a volunteer. I mean, they never let you go. Thank you. I'll answer questions, but if you want to do it individually.
Is your organization planning anything special for the 50th?
Well, we're going to have our convention this year in May in San Francisco at the Marriott Hotel off the airport. I've been talking to our New England people, and quite a few of them are going. Usually they don't go west of the Mississippi. But, they might go to the point of Phoenix, Arizona, and places that are well known as a nice place to be, but they don't want to go to Wisconsin or Montana or some place like that. They want to go like New Orleans maybe. Well, we go around and we've been probably to 35 different cities around the United States over the last 4 years. We are very fortunate in one respect. The American ex-POWs is the other POW organization of any size. They have about 40,000 members. We only have 4,200, I think. There's only 8,000 of us living. I can call on 3 guys maybe to get together to do something to help. I run the Bataan Day Memorial exercises for the last 25 years, and I do it alone because it's easier. You give yourself a couple extra days to take care of the mail and run everything on.
mail it out, and then, you know, have lists of what you did, whereas if you have a committee, you build a camel instead of a horse, right? But I haven't learned how to work with committees very much. We have a New England chapter, which we formed in 55. I was one of the three people that formed the American Defenders of the Town of Craigdor, and I picked that name, and they agreed, because we were defenders. And we didn't want people to think that we were surrenderers. Yet we didn't surrender. General King surrendered us, the troops on the town. And General Wainwright did for Craigdor, both for the same reason, ran out of ammunition, and we didn't have any food. We were down to probably 900 calories a day on rations, some grain twice a day, and the meat started to go, and all the animals were killed in the jungles, and all the mules were killed, so there was no protein to be had. We were out of ammunition, and there was no purpose in continuing on when they brought such a large amount. On our front lines, 250,000. There's probably 100,000 of them to our 25. Every minute, the fellows told me that were on the front line, the bodies were stacked that high because the Japanese probably had what keeps you awake, medication. We found them with pills, those that we were able to come across. I never killed Japanese face to face the whole time I was there on the town. I shot at them from a distance, but I was shooting at guys that were up in the trees. They tied themselves up in a tree, and when they were shot, they came to them to check them out, see that they were dead. They would find rusty cans of food. They were up there for so long. So, you know, they did their work the way they were trained. It was just that they were so amazed that guys as big as us surrendered, and they were so little, and it was a delight to them to reach up and slap you for some minor infringement. I had to work with Japanese when I was working for Honeywell, and I couldn't find any reason for not getting along. Nobody ever did it, personally ever did anything to me in this country that was Japanese, so why should I feel anything? You know, we've got to live. So it was, you know, like I said, we did the best we could, and we tried to be soldiers all the time. We were prisoners, and we tried to work against the enemy and do everything that we could. We derailed cars. One day we had a load of rocks on a rail car, and it was about a yard, probably wide, along, and I don't know, narrow gauge trailer, it wasn't very wide. So we looked at each other, it was a long day, and we said, I think we ought to take time off today. And we looked around and said, okay. So don't forget, if they get mad, they're going to beat the four of us. We said, all right, let's take a chair. So we ran that thing as fast as we could till we got to the end, and there's a bumper there to stop. Over the bumper and down over the hill, and the cart with the rocks went down about 40, 50 feet. Japanese got mad. Oh, kuda, and all kinds of Japanese words. And they said, for punishment, go down and bring it back up. Hey, no more work on that line for the day. We took our time and brought it up, and it would be time to quit by the time we got it to the top. So we did, we found fun things to do like that, but we said. But as I say, it wasn't going to be funny the next year, because I don't think I would have survived one more winter.